which usually happens sometime between 18 months and their third birthday. The Spanish fighting bulls that make it into the ring live as near wild animals until they're graded and sent to fight at about 4 years old, at which point they have one bad day. So you're saying these bulls have a chance? Not a chance in hell. Clark shook his head. I mean, 1,000-to-1 shot, maybe, if the bull displays such incredible courage that the crowd begs the guy in charge of the fight to pardon it. But for all practical purposes, the bullfight ends with a couple of feet of sharp steel stuck between the bull's shoulder blades and the dead carcass getting dragged off by a team of mules like the ones you saw clomping down the street a few minutes ago. He leaned forward, swirling the rest of his beer in the bottle. You ever read The Dogs of War? Sure, Jack said. You assigned it to us. Clark smiled. I guess I did. Anyhow, take it from an old man who's rapidly approaching his use-by date. Forsyth summed it up about right. I want to go out with a bullet in my chest and blood in my mouth and a gun in my hand. If I was a bull, I'd take a few spears to the shoulders to get an extra year on the range and a chance to use my horns. It'd be better than getting prodded up some alley with a hot shot in my ass so I can walk into a captive bolt. He leaned back in his chair and took a drink. But that's just me. I'd pick Herd Bull, Jack offered, if I got to choose. A few more years, with the added benefits of tending a harem of cows. You young guys. Clark shook his head. I'd imagine every steer once aspired to those same goals. But the odds are pretty grim. My way, I get to keep my nuts and have a chance to hook the guy who's going to kill me. His voice trailed off, and he tipped his beer bottle up the street. Jack's eyes followed slowly. That can't be good, Ryan said. Clark reached into his pocket and pressed the PTT switch on his radio. Heads up, he said. We've got company. Lucilla Fournier, who is now as blonde as Adara, is about 20 yards from the Russians and closing. Chapter 20. Normally, the act of simply crossing the street in Tehran was so dangerous that locals referred to it as going to Chechnya. Authorities had blocked the streets to control protesters during the hangings, so Dovzhenko was able to cross as if he'd been in a city that gave two shits about the lives of its pedestrians. He walked 4 blocks south, under the tall sycamores that lined the shaded walks of Wali Asher Street, named for a 12th-century Shiite imam. The crowd soon thinned to the usual mix of people returning home from work in the rain. Dovzhenko would never have known there had been a hanging, if not for the incandescent images of the kicking boys that still burned in his brain. He'd not eaten anything since the bread and tea he'd had for breakfast, but even the tantalizing smells of saffron and 5-spice drifting out of the shops could not tempt him. The drizzle abated by the time he reached the white subcompact car the embassy had assigned him. Dovzhenko threw his leather jacket in the back seat, which was hardly large enough for a briefcase, let alone a person with legs. He took a moment to light a cigarette before wedging himself in behind the wheel. It was illegal to smoke while driving in Iran, but the law was seldom enforced. And anyway, Dovzhenko was much too disgusted to care. The pitiful little vehicle did not help his mood at all. The Tiba, gazelle in Persian, was anything but fast. It resembled a bloated peanut, or perhaps a Volkswagen Beetle that had been left to melt in the sun. Those sentiments were surely too harsh, but Dovzhenko had too much experience with the little things to be rational. He'd been issued one the year before, during an assignment in Moldova. SVR recruiters tended to draw more romantic images of the life of a clandestine intelligence officer when they spoke to potential trainees. Dovzhenko knew better. The intelligence life was rarely a flashy one. Savile Row suits and Aston Martin sports cars drew unwanted attention. Utilitarian ruled the day. But this was ridiculous. The 80-horsepower monstrosity was more reminiscent of Baba Yaga's cauldron than a car. It was outside the bounds, for even a Russian spy. Dovzhenko was not alone in his assessment. The English-speaking clerk in the Tehran embassy motor pool had gone so far as to dub the little cars axles of evil. But it got him to Mariam's, so Dovzhenko kept his gripes to himself. Mariam Farhad lived in Sharik Yagarb, an upscale neighborhood in the northwest part of the city, far from the drug rehabilitation center where she worked to the south, where homeless addicts hung in the shadows whispering, "Daru, daru," medicine, medicine. Selling drugs, even the green stuff, was a tremendous gamble. A usable amount of cannabis might be overlooked by the authorities, but as little as 5 grams of hash oil was a capital offense. As far as Dovzhenko could tell, the government had decided to combat the exploding opioid problem by handing out so much methadone that it, too, was now sold illicitly. Whatever Tehran's master plan, he was glad Mariam didn't live among the lost souls to whom she'd devoted her life. Dovzhenko could have taken Wali Asr Street north and then gone west on the Hemat Expressway, almost to her doorstep, but he did not have the stomach to see the execution site again, and he wanted to shake any tail Sasani might have on him. IRGC trusted no one. It was the nature of spies. Liars were always the most suspicious of others. In this case, Sasani had good reason. Mariam was a single woman, a Muslim, and Dovzhenko was not. His position in the SVR would save him from execution, but their affair would surely get him expelled from the country, not to mention the black mark it would place on his record. Dovzhenko told himself it did not matter what happened to him, but the consequences to her would be swift and violent. A brutal whipping, re-education, or if a judge got it in his head that she was corrupting the earth, Dovzhenko had seen the pit behind the walls of Evin, the hole used to bury men up to their waists and women to their necks, the smooth stones the size of apples arranged in neat pyramids for easy access. Officially, Iran had done away with stoning. What a joke. The members of the Guardian Council did whatever they wished. If stoning went against an official edict, they simply issued a new one, granting themselves permission. World opinion didn't stop them. It just moved the behavior indoors. Dovzhenko worked his way north, tamping back images of what could happen to his girlfriend. They were both accustomed to risk. SVR had no rules prohibiting the consumption of alcohol, even in a Muslim country, provided one kept to oneself and did not overindulge. But attending one of Tehran's numerous underground parties on anything other than official business was not only frowned upon, the prohibition against it was noted specifically in the documented rules new members of the Russian delegation had to sign upon arrival. Dovzhenko found one on his second weekend, in the basement of a flower shop right in Sharik Yagarb, less than a mile from Mariam's apartment. Enforcement by the morality police against these parties, where alcohol flowed and bodies swayed to Western music, came in fits and starts, or not at all. 2 of the young people at the first party he'd attended were supposedly sons of prominent mullahs. No one wanted to get crossways with them. So for the most part, the gatherings went unmolested. He'd seen Mariam Farhad 15 minutes into his first visit. She was about his age, a few years older than most of the college-age kids who smoked and drank absinthe and explored the heady stuff of free thought, even if it was in secret. Dovzhenko had worn his best shirt, open at the collar. Unlike most of the young men at the party, he was old enough to know that wearing a little less cologne and no gold chains caused him to stand out as being more mature. Mariam had smiled at him as soon as she'd removed her coat. Her hips swayed to the music before she'd taken 2 full steps, as if she'd contained them as long as she possibly could. She wore a silk blouse, tight enough across the chest to pull the buttons just a little and expose an inch or two of lace underneath. This happened all the time in Russia or the U.S., but in Iran, where women wore mandated headscarves and ill-fitting clothes, the look was scandalous. One of the male officials at the embassy had lamented what he called the Nosgrudi paradox. The observation that the Iranian women with whom he was acquainted who possessed decent breasts also had extremely large noses. Conversely, the more delicate and beautiful the nose, the more barren the landscape when it came to bosom. Dovzhenko had dismissed the sentiment as nikolchurny, boorish, but was ashamed to note that Maryam Farhad was a beautiful exception to this apparatchik's imagined paradox. And as boorish as it was, the thought of her body only made him want to see her more. But they had to be careful. Now he used the slow pace of the stop-and-go traffic to keep an eye out for any telltale signs that he was being followed. He felt reasonably sure he was clean by the time he turned west on the Hakim, but took the time to get on and off the highway twice, one eye on his rearview mirror, the other on the evening traffic. It seemed that every other car was a Porsche, each a testament to Iranian resiliency in the face of Western sanctions. He'd seen nothing out of the ordinary in his mirror since leaving Wali Asr. It took several cars to conduct rolling surveillance, even against an untrained target, and Dovzhenko knew the tricks. He'd be able to smoke out any IRGC goons like cheap cigarettes. He got off the Hakim Expressway at Paradisan Park, a collection of wooded trails and unfinished gravel pits that served as home to monkeys, rabbits, and strange small-eared wildcats that Maryam called cute, but Dovzhenko thought looked alien. They'd come here once before, never holding hands, but walking side by side, thrilled and terrified at the notion of getting caught socializing as an unmarried couple. They spoke of her love for opera, of great books, and Rome, where he had spent time, but she had not. He drove around the park twice now, as if he were lost, then stopped to check his rear tire at the top of a gravel hill with a good 360-degree view. Clean. Or as clean as one could be in a place where toxic air turned a white shirt yellow inside a month's time. Maryam's apartment was on Second, a dead-end street. Dovzhenko parked the Tiba in a business parking lot on Fifth, giving him more than one exit, and walked the block and a half. He enjoyed the walk. Recent rains and the near-constant breeze here in the north kept the air cleaner than in other parts of the city. Dovzhenko let himself inside with his key. The apartment was well-appointed, like much on the hillside. Garbage washed downhill, so most things were nice here in the north of Tehran. Still in his damp leather jacket, he slumped in a living room chair and lit a cigarette. A driftwood sculpture dominated the center of a glass coffee table. Pictures of seascapes covered the freshly painted walls. He'd thought it odd at first. Maryam didn't seem to care so much for the water, and then other inconsistencies cropped up over the course of his visits. It had once taken her several minutes to find the closet where she stored extra toilet paper, and then she could not locate the five spice. This rose petal-based seasoning was ubiquitous in Iranian kitchens, and misplacing it was akin to a Russian wife saying she couldn't remember where she kept her tea. Maryam had finally admitted that the apartment was not actually hers, but borrowed from a friend who was traveling. Recalling that conversation now made Dovzhenko feel guilty for smoking, and he stubbed out the cigarette in a clay ashtray beside the driftwood centerpiece. He slipped the extinguished cigarette butt into his jacket pocket, a habit drilled into him by his mother before he even went to training. She could have warned him not to smoke instead of teaching him to erase the clues of his presence, his saliva, his particular brand of cigarette. But such were the lessons of a mother who was also a spy. A metallic rattle drew his attention to the door. His hand drifted to the 9x18 Makarov in his jacket pocket. He sometimes felt a little outgunned by the larger Sig Sauer 45s the IRGC carried. But the little Makarov had been around since the Cold War, was still issued, and he could shoot it with deadly effect. He relaxed a notch when Maryam came through the door and pushed it shut with her lovely hip. She flipped the deadbolt while she juggled a briefcase and a canvas bag of bread and vegetables. At 37, she was a year younger than Dovzhenko. She wore a fashionable pantsuit of dark blue, loose enough to hide the swells and curves that he knew were underneath. With most of her body covered, He was immediately drawn to her eyes. And what eyes they were, wide and round, and the color of mossy agate. Not exactly brown, but not quite green. She reminded him of the American actress Natalia Wood. Dark hair, damp from the rain, peaked from the front of a compulsory headscarf that matched her blue slacks. Yarusari yatusari, she often said. A scarf or a beating. He rose quickly, taking the bags. Any trouble? He asked. She'd not had to walk far, but the morality police often patrolled the areas around the metro stations and grocers at this time of the evening. None, she said, voice husky, matching the earthy intensity of her eyes. I used Gershad to get me past the idiots quite unmolested. Dovshenko would have laughed had it not been so tragic. Gershad was an app used to avoid the Gashta Ershad, or morality police. Similar to mobile applications that warned of a radar trap, users of Gershad posted locations where they had seen the charter-clad women and uniformed officers. Icons of bald, bearded morality goons appeared on a map of the city. To Mariam and other women who wished to wear their scarves pushed back an extra inch, or enjoy a cup of tea with a male acquaintance, the app was as normal as using a GPS to navigate to an unknown address. I found fresh cucumber and tomato. Hothouse this early in the year, but they looked nice. She kissed him, grabbing him by the belt buckle when he turned for the kitchen. What a cold little hand, he said, quoting her favorite opera. She scoffed. You are aware that Mimi dies in La Boheme? I know, he said, but I do not feel like being happy today. She pulled him closer. Do you feel like being hungry? Not really. Nor do I, she said. Not for hothouse tomatoes, anyway. She turned for the bathroom, as she always did when she got home. He joked that she was conditioned to pee as soon as she saw her own front door. When she came out a moment later, she was minus the rusari and her jacket. That is much better, she sighed, tripping out of her shoes as she led him by the hand into the bedroom. Chapter 21 Later, much later, Dovzhenko lay with one hand behind his head, the other tracing the small bumps of Mariam's spine. She sat hunched forward, arms hugging the tangle of sheets that was pulled over her knees. Shoulders bare, she was beautifully exposed down to the twin dimples at the small of her back. An engraved pendant was suspended on a silver chain against her breasts. Usually one for quiet banter, she was silent now, which meant she had something important on her mind. Dovzhenko continued to run his fingers along her skin and gave her time to think. At length, she leaned against the headboard and lifted the necklace over her head. She held up the pendant, letting it swing to and fro as if to hypnotize him. Do you know what this is? A flower, he said, giving a little shrug. He let his hand slide down her side to touch her knee. It is an inverted tulip, she said. A lily, actually, that grows on the mountains above us. We call it Ashk Yamariam, Mariam's tears. She took a deep, shuddering breath. I tell you this, because I want you to know me. Dovzhenko sat up beside her and put a finger to her lips. I know enough to be happy. You Russians, she said. You are so fond of fairy tales that you shy away from real life. I am being honest, Dovzhenko said. I know you well enough. No, she said, pulling away. You do not. But I know you. What you do. She rolled to reach for her cigarette on the side table, flicked open the metal case, and then held out a trembling palm. He gave her his lighter and then sat back again, eyeing her. Okay, then, he said. What do I do? Do you think I am stupid? She picked a fleck of tobacco from her lip and blew a cloud of smoke at his face, clicking the lighter open and shut, open and shut. Any Russian who stays in Iran for as long as you have is either a scientist or a spy. She gave him a wan smile. And you are not quite boring enough to be a scientist. Mariam. Dovzhenko began to trace a circle on the hollow of her hip. I am merely an advisor to your government science programs. I am telling you that... Her words came softly, like the chirp of a distant bird, but they silenced Dovzhenko all the same. You would be a beautiful man if you did not lie. She suddenly slipped down among the sheets, more on them than in them, on her side now, cigarette held in a cocked hand over her shoulder as she looked directly into his eyes. O fire of my heart, you have a pistol in your jacket, along with a small radio and a leather truncheon. That does not seem typical for an advisor, even in Iran. Dovzhenko stared at her, stunned. So what now? Mariam's breast brushed against his arm as she fell away. She put the cigarette to her lips and stared at the ceiling. It is better to be slapped with the truth than kissed with a lie, she said. Dovzhenko groaned. True enough. Her head fell sideways against the pillow, looking at him. Then here is the slap. Mariam, what do you know of me? You are a kind soul, he whispered. You work with drug addicts. She put a finger to his lips. Stop it. Be honest with me, if that is even possible for a man in your job. Where were you tonight, immediately before you came here to the apartment? The executions, he whispered. She nodded thoughtfully, eyelids trembling as she took another drag on the cigarette. I thought as much, she whispered. They were friends of mine, you know. Those boys. Tears welled in her eyes. Looking up at the ceiling, she threw an arm across her forehead. You must arrest me now. Take me to the Evin dungeons to string me up and perform your interrogations. Merely knowing someone is not a crime, Dovzhenko said, aware that as a practical matter, this was not the case in Iran or Russia. I am a part of it, she whispered into the crook of her arm. All of it, involved enough in the planning of this movement to get myself hanged. For a while, it seemed as though freedoms might win out, but with the help of their IRGC attack dogs, the Guardian Council will always win, no matter what we do. I am so tired, my love. Those monsters murdered my friends, and for what? For doing what thousands of others are doing. So go ahead and report me. Arrest me. Better yet, shoot me now. I am beyond caring. Dovzhenko swung his feet off the bed and walked naked to the chair where he'd draped his leather jacket. He retrieved the radio and clicked it on. Static and chatter came over the speaker. Sasani and his operatives out working the streets, hunting. Sepa, Mariam gasped, using the colloquial name for the IRGC. Her face drew tight, as if she'd not been quite sure how deeply he was involved with Iranian authorities until now. He pushed the radio toward her. Take it, he said. You may turn yourself in if you wish, but I would never give you over to those animals. She stubbed out the cigarette in the ashtray beside the bed and collapsed against her pillows, sobbing. He nestled in close to her. I am truly sorry for your friends.
Did you?
He shook his head. No, he said.
I am not an interrogator.
He did not mention that he had been there to see almost every bloody, bone-crunching second of it. She was too fragile. For now, at least. Some slaps of truth were too brutal.
How did you know them?
I told you.
She sighed.
I am part of it.
You have all the evidence you need to hang me. If I am wrong about you and you turn me in, then I will die of a broken heart before a noose can touch my throat. I would never.
He was surprised at how the truth sounded so like the lies of his past.
It does not matter, she said. These young people are exceptionally brave. But they need guidance, someone to lead them. Like Reza Kazem, Dovzhenko said. She rolled her eyes. Reza Kazem. He speaks the right words, but there is more wind than substance. Something is off with that one. I will tell you that much.
You have met him.
She turned to the side table and retrieved her mobile, stretching beautifully, causing Dovzhenko to catch his breath when the sheet fell away. She rolled over beside him, mobile phone in both hands, and then entered a password with her thumbs, following that with a longer code to bring up her photos. He nodded at the screen.
You are aware that government agencies have ways around these passwords.
She shrugged and pushed the phone toward him. I told you. I am too tired to care. Dovzhenko needed a cigarette, but he wanted to look at the phone first. Not for evidence, but because he was curious. On his back, he held the phone above his face, shoulder to shoulder with Mariam, while he scrolled through the photos one by one. Smiling students, a bouquet of spring flowers, more flowers. The fifth photo made Dovzhenko sit up straight against the headboard. He zoomed in to get a better look, and then turned to stare down at Mariam. What? She said, incredulous. I already said I knew them. Are you suddenly angry with... He put a hand on her arm, tenderly, he hoped. It only frightened her, and she jerked away. This man. Dovzhenko turned the screen so she could look at the photograph. Have you seen him before? She shrugged. Kazem? I have. Several times. Not Kazem, Dovzhenko said. The other one. The one standing behind Javad. She shook her head. Eric, you scare me. This man is Vitaly Olov, a general officer of the Glavnoye Razvedyavetelnoye Upravlenye, the GRU, Russia's main intelligence directorate. You Russians are everywhere, she said. I did not pay any attention to him when I took the photo. May I get a copy of this? Of course, Mariam said. But that does not seem wise. Will that not leave a digital trail, linking you to my account? He turned to smile at her. Very good, he said. I do not plan to send it to myself directly. I will post it on a dummy auction account on eBay, untraceable to me or anyone connected to me. I will be able to access it without downloading it and leaving any tracks. That sounds much more spy-like, Mariam said. She sat up beside him now, leaning in so her arms intertwined around his elbow, lips buzzing against his shoulder. Is this General Olov your boss? He shook his head, working Mariam's phone to post the photograph of Olov and Kazem. No, I am SVR. The GRU is a different entity altogether. He tapped the phone against his palm. I cannot understand why a Russian officer would meet with the leader of your protest movement. Officially, my government backs the... On the table beside the bed, Dovzhenko's radio suddenly crackled with static, causing both of them to jump with a start. Parviz Sassani's toxic voice spilled over the airwaves. Dovzhenko had a passable understanding of Farsi, but Mariam translated anyway. Units 3 and 4. Come in from the north on Priyuzan. We will approach from the south, blocking any escape. Third floor. Number. She looked up at Dovzhenko, and they both mouthed the same words. They are coming here.
Chapter 22.
She's 15 yards out, Clark said into the radio. Blonde hair, shorter than Adara's. White knee-length shorts, black t-shirt. She's getting plenty of attention. She's wearing sandals, Jack noted. Looks like she's not planning to run. Okay, Clark said, lips just inches from his beer. Passers-by would think he was talking to Ryan. I have Dehosha now. He's coming in from the other direction. No weapons that I can see so far. Ding, Midas. Start to drift his way in case they split up when we go inside the plaza. I'd like to keep eyes on Dehosha. Adara, Dom, you two ease this way, but hang behind a little. I haven't seen any Russian counter-surveillance yet, but they're out there. I'm sure of it.
Jack tapped the table to get Clark's attention. Fournier's carrying something. My friends, Dahosha said, striding purposefully up to the seated Russians. He kept his hands in the open so as not to alarm anyone who might be lurking in the shadows. What a small world it is, meeting you twice in 1 week. Both Russians pushed away from the table and stood, as did the Spaniard. Dahosha's mouth fell open in mock astonishment. Do my eyes deceive me, or is this Don Felipe Montes? He took a half step toward the street, forcing the Spaniard to turn into the sun to look at him. Montes gave the Russians a wary glance. This man is a friend of yours? A mere acquaintance, Dahosha said, still driving the conversation. And a hopeful business partner, to be sure. He turned to glance at Lucilla, who'd stopped a few steps behind the Spaniard. In any case, I will not bother you any longer. I am only here by chance. It seems as though my taxi dropped me off in the wrong location. Is the Bull Arena somewhere nearby? The Spaniard stifled a grin and pointed west. You are standing in its very shadow, senor. Dahosha looked across the street and scratched his head. I expected it to be larger, he said. Are you certain? Where would one go inside? Montes rolled his eyes at the Russians, who had yet to say a single word, and then stepped sideways, away from the Russians. He took Dahosha by the shoulder and pointed down a narrow cobblestone pedestrian alley that ran adjacent to the Plaza de Toros. Down there, Dahosha said. Follow the crowd, Montes said. Dahosha stepped away, throwing a glance at the Russians, as if to say, watch this. Lucilla Fournier walked forward, passing the little crowd by the curb as she touched Don Felipe with her mobile phone. The Spaniard gave a little jump, like she'd given him a shock. His jaw moved back and forth as a hand shot to his collar, trying to get more air. Dahosha sprang to help, assisting the man as he stumbled backward to collapse into his chair. He remained upright, eyes open, arms trailing down beside him. Those seated at nearby tables might have thought the poor man was just winded, or perhaps overcome by the brightness of the sun. Dahosha patted the man's arm, as if checking on a friend. What have you done? The Russian with the long upper lip said. Dahosha had correctly identified him as the leader. A demonstration, Dahosha said, the newest in shellfish toxin. Not all armaments need to include facial recognition or advanced GPS, though I certainly have that as well if you want it. Both Russians glanced nervously up and down the street, wanting to put distance between themselves and the dead Spaniard, but unsure of what would come next. Shellfish toxin, the Russian with the odd haircut asked. How would you even know he is allergic? Lucilla laughed out loud. Monsieur, everyone is allergic to this shellfish toxin. Amazing, Dahosha said, how quickly it worked, wouldn't you say? He dropped a business card on the table in front of the Russians. We both know that you are in the market for someone with certain skills and contacts. I assure you, a business arrangement with me would not disappoint you. He patted the dead Spaniard on the shoulder. As you can see, I am very resourceful. Clark had to concentrate to keep from jumping to his feet. Everyone stay put, he said. The guy in the beret was just hit. Anyone hear a shot? No one had. This was something else, Jack said. Poison, maybe. Ricin? Midas mused. A little too quick for that, Clark said. She jabbed him with something, though. The Russians are moving now. Dahosha and the woman are coming toward you, Adara. See if you can figure out where they are staying, but be alert. Ballsy, Ding said. That makes two that we know of who she's killed in front of a large and hostile audience. Yeah, Clark said. Like I said, everyone keep your heads on a swivel. He nodded at Ryan, who left a couple of euros on the table to pay for their beers. The Russians walked east on Calle Adriano toward their hotel, leaving the dead local and the bullfighting arena behind. For the time being, at least, they seemed to have lost their taste for blood. Chapter 23. Dovzhenko sprang out of the bed, hopping on one foot as he put on his slacks. He was already buttoning his shirt before he realized Mariam wasn't moving.
What are you doing?
He slipped the Vostok watch over his wrist, shoving his feet into his shoes. His socks went into his pockets. There was no time to put them on.
Get up. We have to go.
A lock of dark hair fell across an agate-colored eye.
You are the fire of my heart, she said. But if they find us together, we are both dead. They will only interrogate me.
No. Dovzhenko grabbed her arm, dragging her across the sheets. She didn't struggle, but she didn't help either. It was like dragging a dead woman. He felt like crying.
They would not dare harm a Russian intelligence officer. We are allies.
Her eyes were half closed, sleepy, trance-like.
You could tell them I was your prisoner. Perhaps you could go a little easier on my feet with the truncheon. Why are you doing this?
A sob caught hard in his throat.
Please, come with me.
Where?
She tore the pendant off her neck and handed it to him.
Please go. You must escape so I can see you again, even if I am in a cell.
I won't leave you.
She sighed.
My love, if you do not, we will both be killed. Our only chance is for you to go. Now.
Dovzhenko stuffed the silver necklace in his pocket and then, exasperated, kissed her hard before sliding open the rear window.
I'll be right back.
He switched off his radio and vaulted over the rail, letting his body extend fully so he could drop to the next balcony below. He repeated the process twice more on the second and first floor balconies, dropping the last few feet to land among a hedge of thorny shrubs. Tires squealed around the corner as a vehicle turned quickly off 2nd Street and came to a stop in the parking lot out front. Dovzhenko ran south without looking back, cutting between dark apartment buildings and vaulting several fences to put some distance between him and Sasani's men. 2 minutes later, he turned to the east through a neighborhood of large single-family homes toward his parked car. Motion lights came on in nearly every yard, blinding him. He narrowly avoided tripping headlong into a backyard pond. He reached his car in less than 5 minutes, hands on his knees, wheezing for air. He really needed to stop smoking. His hand darted to the pocket of his slacks. His lighter. He checked his jacket, feeling like he might pass out at the cold realization that he'd left the lighter at the apartment. Sasani would surely recognize the Azerbaijani crest. The clatter of gunfire tore at the night. Dovzhenko choked back a scream. Jumping behind the wheel, he started the little Tiba and threw it into gear, pointing it toward Mariam and the gunfire. He willed the gutless car to go faster. He had to get inside and retrieve the lighter before Sasani found it. If he could not, then he would at least have the pleasure of shooting the son of a bitch in the face before they arrested him. Dovzhenko parked and jumped out of the Tiba, sprinting up 3 flights of stairs. A young IRGC thug stopped him at the apartment door.
What are you doing here?
It was the same one he'd given the binoculars to, a foolish gesture that only made him look odd. And in the intelligence world, odd was very much akin to guilty.
I received the tip, Dovzhenko said, forcing his breath to slow. I could ask the same question.
We have also received a tip. Sasani strode around the corner, sleeves of his collarless gray shirt rolled up, a tight pair of black leather gloves stretched over his hands. Dovzhenko shouldered his way past the door guard, biting his tongue when he saw Mariam's arm trailing off the bed. A rivulet of blood ran from the crook of her elbow to drip from the tips of her fingers. He bit the inside of his cheek to keep from giving himself away.
I am confused, comrade,
Sasani said, head cocked to the side.
Why did you not call us?
It was merely a tip, Dovzhenko said. I am as surprised to see you as you are me.
He moved around the room, touching as much as he could without looking too obvious. His fingerprints were everywhere. The sunken divot from where he'd sat on the couch to smoke was still in the cushion. He glanced at the ashtray and thought of the cigarette butt in his pocket. He and Mariam had made love twice, and she'd never gotten out of bed. He was all over this place. Sasani looked him up and down for a long moment, like a dog looks at a piece of meat it cannot quite reach.
She resisted? Dovzhenko heard himself ask, the words hollow, distant, though from his own mouth. It was only then that he noticed one of Sasani's men holding a bandage to his arm.
The bitch shot me, the man said.
Bravo, Dovzhenko thought.
He'd not known Mariam even had a gun.
He moved into the bedroom as if he owned the place, a skill at which Russians were particularly adept.
Intelligence training had taught him to swallow his emotions, to lie with his eyes in order to make his words believable. Seeing Mariam's bullet-riddled body was impossibly difficult, but he dug deep and somehow mustered the wherewithal to appear appropriately shocked at the scene, without breaking down completely.
What a waste, he said, forcing himself to approach the bed so he could look for his lost lighter. If it was on the floor, he could find a way past this. If it was tangled in the sheets, he was doomed.
A cursory search revealed nothing, and he leaned over the bed, swallowing the fury that threatened to overpower him. Most of Mariam's wounds were to her chest, but there were two to her neck. Blood soaked the sheets and mattress underneath. But when he squinted and blocked out the worst of it, he could almost imagine she was just asleep. Sasani's eyes burned holes in the back of his neck. He closed his eyes, controlling his breathing before turning to face the IRGC thug.
The whore was with someone, Sasani said, just before we arrived.
Dovzhenko stared at the man, playing out the scene in his mind. The Makarov pistol held 8 rounds in the magazine and 1 in the chamber. The little 9x18 was stout enough to do the job, but few pistol calibers were optimum as offensive weapons. They often took time to neutralize a threat. Sasani and 3 of his men were in the bedroom. 2 shots for each of them gave him 1 to spare. He would shoot Sasani first, once in the face, following up with 2 shots apiece to the other 3. Then Dovzhenko would put a second into Sasani's groin, even if he didn't need it, because he'd called Mariam a whore. Rather than reload, he'd grab one of the Sig Sauer 45s and shoot the other 3 IRGC thugs as they came in to investigate. He might even make it as far as the Russian embassy, where his own people would take him into custody.
Sir, one of Sasani's men said from the side of the bed, look at this.
He held up the gold lighter.
Thank you, Dovzhenko said, snatching it away. Only bluster and bravado would do now. If he acted guilty, they would smell it. It must have fallen out of my pocket when I looked at the body.
Sasani regarded him with a narrow eye. He said nothing, but gave the other officer a small nod, as if to say, carry on, we will talk later.
An autopsy will be performed. As a matter of policy, Sasani said, lips pulled back in a tight smile. As I said, she was with someone. DNA tests will tell us the ethnicity of her lover.
A wise course of action, Dovzhenko said. He looked at Mariam's lifeless body. It was a mercy that she'd been spared the torment Sasani and his men would have meted out. Rape, bastinado, burning. Nothing was too base for these men.
You know, Sasani said, she is not even the name on the lease for this apartment.
He turned to the man that stood nearest the bedroom door.
What is her name?
Mariam Farhad, sir.
Ah, yes. Mariam, Sasani said. A pious name for a whore.
Dovzhenko suddenly found himself extremely tired.
How did you find her, then?
As I said, a tip, just like you.
We were lucky.
I think we should talk to the actual owner next, don't you?
A wise move.
Dovzhenko groaned inside. He had never met Mariam's friend, but he knew now that he had to find her and warn her.
I need to piss, he said. I won't touch anything.
By all means, Sasani said. Piss, I don't care.
Dovzhenko started to turn for the bathroom, but paused at the bedroom door as if he did not know exactly where it was. Mariam's jacket lay on the floor where she'd dropped it earlier that evening.
He flushed the toilet, using the noise of swirling water to cover the jingle of her keys as he lifted the jacket to his nose, breathing in the smell of her, blinking back tears. He pulled himself together, then found what he was looking for in the pocket, before gently returning the jacket to the floor. "What is wrong?" Sasani asked when Dovzhenko came out of the bathroom. He was still grinning. "You look as though the weight of the world is on your shoulders, my friend."
"We are not friends," Dovzhenko said.
"That," Sasani said, "is becoming more obvious to me by the minute. But for argument's sake, why is that not so?"
"Because I killed a whore."
"Her?" Dovzhenko remembered he was a spy in time to scoff. "She is nothing. This is a nasty business we are in, and sometimes we must both do nasty things. The difference is you enjoy it too much." He turned his back on the IRGC men and walked toward the door. There was only one way forward for him now, a way that, if he were honest with himself, he'd been considering for some time. But first, he had to find a woman named Isabel Kashani. Chapter 24. Mandy Cruz considered going blue and activating the flashing light in the doll-sized outhouse to let the 44 other watchstanders know she was leaving her desk to use the restroom, and they needed to remain on station. Colloquially referred to as ops, the State Department Operations Center was located just down the hall from the secretary's office, beyond a set of frosted doors and two armed guards. In the shadowy world where diplomacy and intelligence merged, secrets were compartmentalized behind countless locks, and ops held one of the biggest key rings in government. Those on watch were call takers, dispatchers, facilitators, problem solvers, and intrepid detectives who were trained to bird-dog a task until it was accomplished. If the secretary needed to speak with a specific ambassador who could not be located, someone from ops found out where he played racquetball, where she golfed, or if he or she enjoyed a long lunch at the hotel with a significant other. More than once, there had been heavy breathing on the line when she finally got through. But Cruz didn't care. People had to live their lives. Her business was to answer when they called, find them when they were needed, and connect them with the boss. Just 15 minutes earlier, Cruz had taken the S icon representing the Secretary of State on her computer screen and dropped it into a box with the icon for the Foreign Minister of South Korea, connecting the call. Someone else took notes on the conversation, but generally speaking, Cruz could figure out the gist of what was going on by the information that passed across her desk. 5 minutes after the call with Korea, Secretary Adler's box had dropped in with an icon representing Foreign Minister Tinubu of Nigeria. 2 minutes after that, the group supervisor had set up a special Cameroon task force and briefed everyone in ops. Cruz was pulled from her regular duties to focus on the embassy takeover. 9 minutes after Task Force Cameroon was up and running, Cruz's headset chirped. She clicked her computer mouse to answer the call. "Hello, Ops," the voice on the other end of the line said, relieved, as if coming up for air. "Special Agent Aiden Carr in Yaoundé, Cameroon. The ambassador is safe. I'm talking on a stolen cell phone, so we are not, I repeat, not secure." Cruz hit another icon on her screen, notifying her group supervisor that she had a priority caller on the line having to do with Task Force Cameroon. "Special Agent Carr," Cruz said, "I'm connecting you with the secretary right now." She dropped the icons, but stayed on the line. The call would be recorded, and in this situation, all involved stayed on to ensure the call wasn't fumbled or dropped completely. The secretary came on the line an instant later, asking the question the agent surely wanted to hear. "Aiden, this is Scott Adler. What do you need first?" The chief of staff, secretaries of defense and state, and the director of national security stood in the middle of the oval in the closest thing to parade rest they could muster while holding their leather folios. "They're moving her," Adler said. "Carr will get back with us as soon as he can." Ryan's desk line buzzed and Betty's voice came over the speaker. "Mr. President, I have President Njaya of Cameroon on the line." Ryan put the phone on speaker.
Francois, thank you for taking my call.
Of course, Mr. President. These are most concerning reports I am hearing.
That's putting it mildly, Francois. Ryan cut to the chase. I need Mrs. Porter released without delay. We can discuss the embassy after she's safe.
I understand, Jack, Njaya said. I, too, am concerned for the safety of Mrs. Porter. These military officers who have taken her have so far shown restraint, but I am not sure how long that will continue.
What could they hope to gain, Francois? Ryan asked, playing along with the farcical game. Your military has mounted an attack on United States soil.
Njaya huffed. Jack, I would not go so far as to say it was an attack. Put the shoe on the other foot.
I see, Njaya said.
I do not dispute the fact that your embassy is American soil. The men who surround it are merely angry at the aggression against the sovereignty of Cameroon. I am sure this can all be sorted out.
Have you been able to figure out why? Ryan asked.
Njaya knew exactly why. It may have taken on a life of its own now. Matters with rogue militaries usually did, but Njaya had certainly ordered it. Ryan didn't want to play his hand. Yet.
This, I believe, I can answer, Njaya said. A teacher at a secondary school here in Yaoundé discovered your very disturbing video on the internet.
You are a smart man, Jack, Njaya said pithily, animosity creeping into his voice for the first time.
Perhaps we should stop playing games. In this video, you pledge your support to General Mbida and the Anglophones. How could you do such a thing, Mr. President? I would have contacted you directly to work it out, but once my supporters became aware of this video, they began to act of their own accord. It will take some time for me to restore calm.
That video is obviously doctored, Ryan said. You cannot believe everything you see online. Surely you know that, Francois.
Come now, Mr. President, Njaya said. It is your face and your voice. Have your people take a look at the metadata. They will prove me out.
I will do just that, Njaya said.
And your military, Ryan asked. What are they going to do? Before you answer, I will remind you that the United States has been your partner against Boko Haram for many years.
As I say, Mr. President, Njaya said, I am sure they will get this sorted out very soon. In the meantime, it would go a long way to bringing this matter to a close if your embassy personnel would send out Mbida.
There's a big difference in someone asking for asylum and someone being held against their will. Before we talk about anything else, Mrs. Porter must be released.
But I do not know where she is, Njaya said, barely concealing his duplicity.
Do you, Mr. President?
Francois, Ryan said through clenched teeth. I would think these rogue members of your military would not want the United States as an enemy.
It would seem to me, Njaya said, that it is you who cannot afford another enemy. What with everything else you are facing, the influenza, loss of public trust, I should think you would want to clear up this unfortunate incident quickly, before lives are lost.
Francois, Ryan said, seething now. They do not want to test me.
Oh, Mr. President.
The gloating smile was evident in Njaya's tone.
One of your own senators has already accused you of bullying those who do not agree with you.
Ryan's face twitched. Mary Pat Foley, the only one in the room brave enough to approach him at the moment, stepped up to pat a hand on his arm for support. He waved her off, nodding that he was all right.
Njaya, uncomfortable with the silence, spoke again.
I am telling you, Jack, this is not my doing.
I understand, Ryan said, and I assure you, Francois, help is on the way. You will not have to take care of this alone.
Jack, Njaya said, you must not act unilaterally.
Oh, I'm not, Ryan said. Not at all. Our countries have had a mutual aid agreement to fight Boko Haram for many years. You have already invited us.
Come now, Jack. We're losing the connection, Francois.
Ryan ended the call. He took a deep breath and then put both hands flat on the desk in front of him.
We're attack plus 5 hours, and so far we have what? 2 UAVs and 1 DSS agent on station? I want all of you thinking about options. Everything's on the table. DevGru, Delta, the 82nd Airborne. Hell, an entire Marine Expeditionary Force. Let's get Task Force Darby headed south. Whatever it takes to get this woman out safely and protect our embassy. Am I clear? Van Damme said, the hostage response group fusion cell is... Ryan pushed away from his desk. Arnie, he said, after a deep, deliberative breath. I fully understand the need for the HRG, but I want action. Coordinated, yes, but not just coordinated planning. Understood, Van Damme said. Very well. Ryan stood and shrugged on his suit jacket. I'll be right behind you. Mr. President, Foley said, hanging back as the others filed out toward the Situation Room. Would it be possible to have a momentary word? Ryan smiled. We've been friends long enough for me to recognize an intervention when I see one. You don't want me to go in there and bomb the hell out of Cameroon because N'Jai is a smarmy piece of shit. The thought had occurred to me, Jack, Foley said. And honestly, none of us would blame you. Though that wouldn't make it the right thing to do. Ryan stifled a chuckle. My old man always said that handling anger was like climbing stairs. Everyone gets winded, no matter how good a shape you're in. It's how fast you recuperate that matters. I might get hot, but I won't boil over. His eyes narrowed. I promise you, if I use force against Francois N'Jaya and his military, it will be overwhelmingly violent, but completely dispassionate. He waved her toward the door. Now go keep the hostage response group in line until I get there. I'll be there in a minute.
Alone, Ryan turned to look past his own reflection in the center window behind his desk and onto the south lawn. He shied away from the spot when anyone else was in the oval, particularly the White House photographer. The whole look was too derivative of JFK, but it was a good thinking spot, dammit. Apart from the comparison of climbing stairs to getting angry, Ryan's father had always encouraged him to take a hard look at what he was angry at, and admit to himself that it was most usually himself. The plain truth was that N'Jaya, for all his gloating, was right. Ryan was in a bad spot. The influenza, the flooding with attendant public health issues in the southeast, this business with Michelle Chadwick, and now an embassy under siege, all added to an already full threat board. The United States had many enemies that would love nothing more than to sit and watch her torn apart, and then swoop in to pick up the pieces. One thing at a time, Jack, Ryan said to his reflection. He had capable hands working on the influenza epidemic and the flooding. Secretary DeHart was on his way to Louisiana to provide a first-hand report. That left Cameroon, with a diplomatic security agent literally hiding in the weeds, and 2 MQ-9 Reaper drones hovering over station. Unmanned aerial vehicles, Ryan said. Low and slow, but they did the job. Some argued that UAVs sanitized war, made it too easy for politicians. If they saved American lives, then Ryan had no problem with them. Ordering Americans into harm's way could never be sanitized. Every bomb dropped, every trigger pulled, did damage on both ends of the weapon. Ordering multiple deaths, or even one, should never be an easy thing. Some people needed to die, but Ryan was not a man to drag it out. Jack Ryan was no shrinking violet. He'd rather be done with it, whatever it was. Aiden Carr crouched behind the rusted box of an old semi-trailer beside the man he should have been protecting. Together they watched a squad of 4 soldiers, armed with French FAMAS rifles, escort Mrs. Porter into a dilapidated warehouse on the western edge of the city. They'd put a cloth bag over her head and tied her hands behind her back for the move. The apparent leader of the group, a man with a bald spot that looked like an appealing target, gave her a shove that sent her to her knees. Carr had to grab Ambassador Burlingame to keep him from rushing into the open. Patience, sir, the DS agent whispered.
I thought you said you wanted to act, Burlingame said. So let's act.
We will, sir, Carr said. But we have to be smart about it. These guys outgun and out-